This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.
Thank you for downloading The Briefing Room with David Aronovich. It's a new Radio 4 programme that aims to provide what you need to know about a big story in the news each week.
There was one person that I needed to interview who was absolutely crucial in the intelligence that led to the war in Iraq. It took us months and months to track him down. It was one of the most difficult yet memorable interviews that I've ever done. He was very evasive. In the end, I said, the fact is that we went to war on a lie, and the person who told that lie was you. And he looked at me, and I waited. Then he smiled, a sly smile I'll never forget, and he said, yes.
That was veteran BBC reporter Peter Taylor talking about a man who was one of the sources of what Sir John Chilcot yesterday called the flawed intelligence that was used to justify the invasion of Iraq. Inside the briefing room today, we'll be trying to understand what happened between the informers, the spooks and the politicians, and whether the flaws were institutional or temporary. In 2013, Peter Taylor interviewed the man they called Curveball for the Panorama programme.
The story begins in a German refugee camp at Zirndorf at the end of 1999, 4 years before the invasion. I remember going there on a freezing cold December day in my journey to try and sort fact from fiction in Curveball's remarkable story. One of the new arrivals amongst those fleeing Saddam's tyrannical regime was Rafed Al-Janabi, later known as Curveball. This is what he told me.
My dream was not only my dream, but the dream of many Iraqis, to see Saddam Hussein out of power in Iraq.
German intelligence singled him out as an asylum seeker of particular interest because he said he was a chemical engineer who'd worked in a military facility outside Baghdad. The words chemical and military were a magnet.
The man told me they've heard you are a chemical engineer and this concerns the asylum office and the German government.
The head of Germany's foreign intelligence service at the time was August Hanning, who saw the potential of the source that had so unexpectedly fallen into his lap.
It was very difficult to get inside information at that time from Iraq, who has been engaged in this program, and therefore it was a very valuable source.
The problem was that some parts of Curveball's story were true. He had worked at a factory which weapons inspectors thought could have been used to produce biological weapons, but it turned out to be an agricultural plant. He also said he'd witnessed a chemical accident there in which 12 technicians died. But there was no such accident. The Germans struggled to separate fact from fiction, reluctant to write off such an apparently valuable asset, and sent around 100 reports on Curveball to their US counterparts. They also shared the intelligence with the British. Joschka Fischer was Germany's foreign minister at the time.
They didn't know whether this guy was a liar or he is telling the truth. And if he is telling the truth, then there is a serious problem.
With the incentive of political asylum and money on the horizon, Curveball told his interrogators that he'd been involved in developing mobile biological laboratories mounted on trucks, and he even drew sketches.
They gave me an opportunity to say what I wanted. A lot of the information which was given to German intelligence was extremely detailed, and they verified this information.
But the Germans began to have increasing doubts. Towards the end of 2000, Curveball's story began to unravel. Satellite imagery contradicted his description of the layout of the so-called military facility. He said that large trucks with trailers had been driven in and out of one of the warehouses, but images showed such a manoeuvre would have been impossible. At the beginning of 2001, Curveball was out in the cold, flipping burgers at a fast food outlet near Nuremberg. But one seismic event was to change everything and place Curveball centre stage once more.
As we come on air, we have serious news of a major possible air crash in the United States. A plane appears to have crashed into one of New York's tallest buildings.
9/11 gave President Bush the opportunity to achieve his long-term goal of overthrowing Saddam Hussein. What Curveball was saying now seemed too good to dismiss. Chemical weapons, mobile laboratories. The White House used Curveball to underpin the case for war. But doubts were growing. In the spring of 2002, MI6 sent the CIA a cable summing up its position on Curveball.
Elements of his behaviour strike us as typical of individuals we would normally assess as fabricators.
But nevertheless, it was
inclined to believe that a significant part of Curveball's reporting is true.
Tony Blair was specifically briefed about the mobile laboratories. Curveball was the main source for them. The Prime Minister said this was an additional and new factor. Other sources, later dismissed as unreliable, made similar references. Just before Christmas 2002, the head of German Foreign Intelligence, August Hanning, sent a personal cable to CIA Director George Tenet, warning about the intelligence from Curveball.
It is not confirmed. Please be cautious to use this kind of not confirmed information.
And of course he was a single source.
He was a single source, we told them.
The Germans refused to allow Curveball to be interviewed by either the British or the Americans. But Germany's Foreign Minister, Joschka Fischer, believed the warnings were loud and clear. Did you do enough to warn the Americans, to warn the CIA about Curveball?
Yeah. But they were not in a state of, or in a mindset, to be warned.
The month before the invasion, the US Secretary of State Colin Powell prepared to make a landmark speech to the United Nations. Curveball and the mobile laboratories were at the heart of it.
The source was an eyewitness, an Iraqi chemical engineer who supervised one of these facilities. He actually was present during biological agent production runs.
I asked Curveball about this.
Colin Powell said that the source was present during the biological production runs. Were you present then?
He was also at the site when an accident occurred in 1998. 12 technicians died from exposure to biological agents.
Were you present on site?
No.
When an accident occurred?
No.
We have first-hand descriptions of biological weapons factories on wheels and on rails.
You say you provided diagrams.
Yes.
You were making that up?
Yes.
Three days after Colin Powell's presentation, UN inspectors, now finally back in Iraq, visited the site where Curveball said he'd seen the mobile laboratories. Rocco Casagrande was one of the inspectors.
What did you find?
A lot of seed, a lot of corn, a lot of nothing.
In 2004, after Saddam had been deposed, the Germans finally relented and allowed the CIA to interview Curveball. The Americans then declared him to be a fabricator. Soon afterwards, CIA Director George Tenet resigned. MI6 was also given access, after which they formally withdrew the intelligence on the grounds that it had been seriously flawed. At the end of my interview, Curveball said he had no regrets about what he had done. Saddam Hussein had gone. Curveball was happy, and he finally told the truth.
The fact is that we went to war in Iraq on a lie, and that lie was your lie.
Yes.
The man who procured that rather remarkable yes, Peter Taylor, is here with me in the briefing room. Joining us is Stephen Gray, author of The New Spy Masters, and down the line from Santa Fe is the former CIA officer, Valerie Plame. Stephen Gray, you've written about Curveball. What did you find out about him?
Well, the interesting thing about the Chilcot report was it said that the intelligence officers of and the intelligence agencies in Britain, you know, didn't tell a lie. There was no one was deceitful about this story, but yet a lie was produced, or at least a major falsehood. So I went back to the source of all this, Curveball himself, who I met, but also people in German intelligence who handled him. And I discovered that there was basic errors of tradecraft, if you like, in looking after Curveball, in questioning him. He was questioned by someone I call Dr. Peter, who turned out not to be a trained person in handling human intelligence agents. He was an intelligence officer, but he was an analyst, a weapons scientist, in fact. He'd met Curveball before when he was a UN weapons inspector, posing as one and in fact, an officer for German foreign intelligence working in Iraq. He'd met him. And he was strongly convinced prior to meeting Curveball that Saddam Hussein was back in the game of trying to develop German weapons. And I became convinced the more I learned about this handler, who became the most important person in Curveball's life for at least a year, much of this information may have been suggestion that actually Curveball saw the need of this officer in the way that these agencies, and the CIA and MI6 later had this need to gather information and fed what was needed.
So he took the hints from the German officer, which he then fed back, which were then fed back to intelligence agencies abroad. Valerie Plame, you heard there Joschka Fischer talking about the mindset, which was an interesting phrase. Now, try and help us understand, because you were in the CIA at the time, what was the mindset in the period leading up to the invasion of Iraq amongst American and other intelligence agencies?
Right. Well, thank you for having me. To set the stage, of course, no sooner had there was still smoke coming off the World Trade Towers when we know that then Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld was saying, you know, there's not that many targets in Afghanistan, but Iraq, you know, now there we have something. And there was, as we know, a pivot to Iraq. The problem was that we had very little intelligence on what the presumed WMD program might be that Saddam Hussein had. We closed our embassy, the U.S. embassy, after the first Gulf War. The U.N. weapons inspectors had been kicked out in 1998. As it was very clear, the Bush White House was focusing on Iraq. The CIA scrambled frantically to try to cast the net far and wide and see what was there and find intelligence. And that's, you know, that's our job.
Were they worried in being about the possibility of being caught out like they felt they were at 9/11?
Yes. I mean, that is a factor. What we knew after the first Gulf War, Saddam Hussein's son-in-law defected to Jordan, and he told Western intelligence about the nuclear program that apparently had gone completely undetected at that point, or relatively undetected. He was talked into going back to Iraq, which was not a good idea for him. He ended up dead. But that really shook U.S. intelligence, that we had completely missed this. And we were determined not to allow that to happen again.
In other words, there was a mindset that was predetermined to find something because the dangers of not finding something might be even greater.
Indeed. And there was, of course, in the United States, it was such a shock of 9/11. We were still reeling from that. The whole issue of whether we should have pivoted to Iraq in the first, that's a whole other conversation.
It certainly is.
That has to do with ideology. It has to do with those in power. I see it as a perfect storm, a cascade of events that led us to the invasion of Iraq.
Thank you. But Valerie, I'm just going to move this on to Peter very briefly to find out, very briefly, Peter, whether there was a similar kind of mindset in London.
I think there was a similar mindset in London, and that's really evidenced by what was in the September dossier of 2002, where all the qualifications that the Joint Intelligence Committee had put on the intelligence were omitted from the report. And the point of that report and the point of Tony Blair and the close circle around him was to convince the British public, and I think they'd already convinced themselves, that the threat was imminent and was the danger was clear and present.
Stephen Ray, let's go back to first principles. We're an intelligence agency and so on, and we've been given a job. There's a job. There's Saddam's Iraq. You need to get information out of it. What kind of a place is this to try and get secret information from?
Well, this is an incredibly difficult place to recruit agents. It was a very brutal regime which restricted access to foreigners, particularly close to the inner circle. To recruit agents, you need access to people who could be traitors. And what had happened was that after the first Gulf War, there were weapons inspectors that were sent in, and they gave a sort of illusion of access to intelligence in that you had weapons inspectors wandering around, many of them actually serving intelligence officers for Western powers who were deployed with the team, who were essentially able to choose anyone they wanted to meet and seize any document they could in any building they named. It seemed so easy, but of course then they were kicked out and suddenly they had to try and recruit agents, and that is a sort of process that can take years.
So what do you start doing under those circumstances? What kind of people start coming out of the woodwork? We've heard about Saddam's son-in-law who kind of comes over, says we've got this nuclear, and then goes back and gets executed and so on. What are the others?
Well, then you use what they call in the trade sub-sources, certainly on the British side, which is you meet somebody who knows somebody else, and then you get that person to run that other person. And what we saw as it turned out, was that the major pieces of intelligence that the British and the CIA had came from agents they'd never actually met. It was, in some sense, hearsay. Now, it isn't wrong to use such agents. That may be the best way of getting it. But the fact remains, as Chilcot said, there was no direct agent there, and you have to treat that information with kid gloves.
What kind of people are these subsources?
Well, there were military officers that, for example, a defector said that they had a friend back in Iraq who was a major in the Iraqi army, and he told him.
So the defector becomes the middleman then?
That's right.
And so you don't speak to the army officer yourself who's in Iraq. The defector does that, and the defector then reports back to the agency person what that person is saying.
That's right. So people are coming and going from Jordan to Iraq, and the MI6 officer, for example, is in Amman, Jordan, and meets somebody in Jordan and who then relays what they've heard back in Baghdad.
And so how do you go about the business of working out whether or not what they say is true or not?
Well, you have to verify. You have to, first of all, corroborate the actual information, find it from other sources, and you have to try to work out who these subsources are. Could they really have come up with that information? Is it possible they would do that? And are there other technical ways? For example, you can listen into their calls or whatever to see whether it really makes sense what they're saying.
Peter, what happens if sources don't agree?
There is a problem, and I think intermediaries are vital in this chain of reporting that Chilcot refers to. The problem also identified by Chilcot is that when there was intelligence that there was no WMD, this tended to be ignored or dismissed on the grounds, well, of course, they would say that, wouldn't they? The CIA aimed for the top, and they had the resources and the money to do it. And I met the CIA agent who paid out $200,000 in Paris to an intermediary who said he had access to Iraq's foreign minister. Iraq's foreign minister, according to the CIA agent I spoke to, was then recruited and was a source. Naji Sabri was his name, denies he was ever a source. But Naji Sabri allegedly said that Saddam had no WMD. But that was dismissed because, of course, he would say that, wouldn't he? There was another case, very briefly, where...
So they paid $200,000 to get somebody, to get some information from somebody, and when it came in, because it didn't really fit with what they thought they were hearing from elsewhere, they decided not to listen to it.
It's slightly more complicated, but essentially you're right. There was another case of an MI6 officer just before the war began who interviewed and met a senior Iraqi intelligence officer who also told him that Saddam had no WMD. That was dismissed because, well, he would say that, wouldn't he?
Now,
but he was right.
Let's move on a step, because this intelligence that we've gathered from the intelligence agency, have gathered from these various sources and which they're evaluating, then once they've done the evaluation, and what do they do then, Stephen? They make a judgment, as in the Joint Intelligence Committee report. On balance, we think that this is a credible source, and we think, therefore, that it is likely that such a programme is going forward. That's essentially how they put it, is it?
Well, the case officer, that's the actual intelligence officer who handles the agent, is expected to use their professional knowledge. I mean, they are very experienced people to evaluate on the spot the information and subsequent reports. But then that's passed up the chain. And the Americans and British do it slightly differently.
Well, I'll ask Valerie about the Americans.
So on the British side, MI6 is an agent-running organisation. It sends up raw intelligence. You know, it can be brought together. They'll eliminate the name of the agent and other information that would identify the source. But that's passed on outside the agency to customers in Whitehall. They include the Foreign Office at number 10. And most importantly, the Joint Intelligence Committee. And that's a cross-Whitehall committee that's supposed to evaluate and work, check this information against, for example, open sources of information and work out, you know, what's the best assessment. But at the same time, what was very clear from Chilcot, you have a direct channel. So an unfiltered channel, which is for the head of C, who's the head of MI6, in this case, Sir Richard Dearlove in the time of Iraq, goes directly to the Prime Minister. And not everyone's quite aware of what is being whispered into the ear of the Prime Minister by C. And that can be a problem when people don't realise that actually something's been oversold.
So are you actually saying that C could go to the Prime Minister and say, well, this Joint Intelligence Committee report that you've got, Prime Minister, I think it's either a little firmer than that or a little less firm or a little bit more problem than that or a little bit of a less... That could happen.
Well, it can happen. I think that the impression that was felt within MI6 from people who were junior to Sir Richard Dearlove, who was then C, was that the case was being oversold, that this material was, if you like, being promoted around Whitehall and oversold beyond what it was worth.
I think also it indicates how exciting this can be. Like, we as journalists, if we get a major source, we're excited by it. Chilcot describes how Sir Richard Dearlove, having been informed that there was a key source whom he describes as being a significant breakthrough and providing potentially phenomenal access that could be the key to unlock the programme, then goes and tells Tony Blair this. So, you know, it's an atmosphere, because these people are human as well. They get excited. And that also colours the climate in which these decisions are made.
Valerie Plame, how does that work in the States? Is that basically the same structure, or does it differ?
No. How it's supposed to work is intelligence comes in from a variety of sources. It is then pulled together by the analyst in the Directorate of Intelligence of the CIA. They are corroborating, they're checking, they're bringing in everything from open source, SIGINT.
What is SIGINT? Remind us.
Yeah, signals intelligence. That's you know, what the NSA is providing.
Image, the NSA being the National Security Agency.
Yes, human intelligence. All that goes together, and it's nicely packaged, and it goes up. There's very strict protocols for that. And it goes up, and it's then disseminated throughout the intelligence community, which if it's very sensitive, it has a very limited distribution then, say, just the president and his closest advisors.
Now, I want to put both to you, Valerie, and to you, Peter, this phenomenon. As a journalist, I've seen what happens when somebody from secret intelligence comes in to brief a newspaper, and that is that everybody gets really excited because we're on the inside track of incredibly important information. Valerie, do you think the same is true in America of American politicians? Is it something that you're sort of a kind of odd attitude of deference to the people who have the kind of secrets in their hands?
Sure, I think that's a human condition, without question. But the whole environment around this time period in the run-up to the war to my mind, this is my opinion, there was a rush to war. As one of your guests had noted, it takes a while to build sources, to build trust, to be able to verify them, to corroborate what they're saying. And there was a rush. There simply wasn't enough time. Furthermore, as you noted, some of these sources, you know, what was promised was money or a visa to the West. And you better believe that there was a rush of information and informants knocking on U.S. embassy doors all over the world, selling, all sorts of things. Maybe there is a tiny little shred of truth in all the other nonsense they were telling us, but we had to check it out, and that takes tremendous amount of resources and time. And meanwhile, the Bush White House is basically pounding on the desk saying, you know, where is it? What do we got?
Well, the thing that Valerie raises there, Peter, is the possibility, I raise the possibility of a kind of seduction of the politicians by the idea of the secret. Of course, the same thing can work in reverse and may have in this case, which is a seduction by the politicians of the intelligence people, a desire to please. Do you think that happened?
I think to a certain extent, yes. There's no doubt that, you know, when politicians are taken into the confidence of the intelligence agencies, they are in a privileged position. When journalists have a meeting with intelligence officers or senior members of the agencies, you know, we are in a privileged position. But we also have to maintain our independence, and one mustn't be seduced by it. And as long as what one reports, you know, is fair and accurate, I think you can just about get away with it. But there's no doubt it is seductive.
Stephen, can I ask you this? In all this, and coming out of the Chilcot report, there comes the image of the value of the person who sits in there and says, he uses the word challenge, I believe, and challenges it and says, have you really thought this through? Is this really the case? Now, you can see in a lot of organisations why that is not a popular job and people don't want to do it. Is that a problem?
It is a problem, but that is the job of the intelligence services to incorporate that element of challenge. We've had for years. We had Soviet defectors walk in, you know, being fed information, trying to trick Western intelligence. We've seen it in wartime with deception. People come forward with exciting pieces of information, and agents, officers, as I think the Americans say, very typically fall in love with their agent. You know, they take it all in, and within the system, there has to be the questioning of it. And what happened in this system was that they really forgot the old lessons. There was nothing particularly new about what went wrong here, but they forgot the stuff that they knew.
Valerie, how do they treat the naysayer in America?
Let me just touch on a previous point. I think the prime example of seducing a politician and vice versa was the director of the CIA, George Tenet, telling President George Bush, this is going to be a slam dunk. That is, you know, he forgot in the moment of sort of that, I don't know, locker room go-go mentality that the CIA is not supposed to provide policy. It provides intelligence, just the facts, ma'am. And to be able to say something like that, he was roundly excoriated, and I think rightly so.
Valerie Plain, I'll have to end it there, I'm afraid, but thank you very much for that answer. Peter Taylor, thank you. Stephen Gray, thank you. That's it for this week from The Briefing Room.
Thanks for listening to The Briefing Room with David Aronovich. It was produced by Joe Kent, mixed by Neil Churchill, and the editor is Innes Bowen. If you enjoyed it, you might also be interested in The Inquiry, the podcast that attempts to answer a pressing question from the news each week with the help of four expert witnesses. Just search online for BBC The Inquiry.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.